Welcome to In Loving Recollection. This is your pal, Brent. Last school year was the first time in my nearly 20 years as a working professional that I shared my morning commute with another person. In fact, it was with two people, my wife and my youngest son, who at the time was 6. Now, I've always considered myself to be a morning person, but I had not realized prior to this new arrangement just how vital my past morning routines were in maintaining this particular personality trait. I mean, listen, I love my son. Couldn't imagine my life without him. But the guy is a bit of a talker, and for me, as someone that was used to spending his mornings with just himself and his thoughts, I knew that this was going to be an adjustment. I wasn't going to be able to do what I had mostly done in the past, which was listen to NPR or podcast. I could maybe put in headphones, but I felt like I should be present for this time we had with one another and really make the most of it. So I decided to start making these daily playlists, which I would also send to our two other sons that weren't with us on the drive, so that we might all be consecrated together in the waters of a thoughtfully curated collection of song. With the commute being around 30 minutes, the playlist would consist of 10 songs each. I'd also set some parameters to maintain while compiling each list. They had to consist equally of both older and newish songs. There had to be at least one instrumental and one song with which I was fairly unfamiliar. I also knew to keep certain types of music out for the benefit of its listeners. These playlists, in theory, were meant to be experienced during a quiet morning drive. The music needed to fit that vibe, so nothing too chaotic or noisy, though I have managed to slip a couple of milder ones in from time to time. So yeah, every day last school year, barring an occasional sick day, there is a new morning playlist available for everyone to enjoy. I'm not sure anyone in my family was all that into them. My wife would argue that they only added extra noise to the ride, as they didn't necessarily curb my son's penchant for constant conversation. But personally, I felt like they were a real success. I really enjoyed this process of compiling and organizing songs. Pretty nerdy shit, I know, but as a fan of both music and routines, I appreciated this daily practice of intentional listening. Having a reason to discover something new, or just being able to revisit some much-loved songs from my past. What would often happen, especially with those older songs, is that it would compel me to go back and listen to the whole record on which they appear. Albums that, a lot of the time, I had not heard in many years. One such instance of this occurred when on list 49, I included the track In the Morning by the Athens, Georgia-based band, Masters of the Hemisphere. It immediately reminded me of how much I loved that band and made me want to listen to their 2002 record, Protest a Dark Anniversary. Now, I first became aware of the Masters because, as I've stated so many times on this show, as a teenager, I was obsessed with music from Athens, Georgia, and the Athens-based independent label Kindercore Records. If a band met either one of those qualifications, it was very likely that I'd be into their music. The Masters had both. To me, they were sort of the quintessential Kindercore band, exhibiting a true DIY spirit and an unabashed love of the perfect pop song. I ate that shit up. I was a true believer and a devoted follower. But as often is the case in life, as time went on, we spent less time with one another. It's not that I liked it any less. It's just that my tastes were continuously growing and beginning to expand beyond the Athens scene I had loved so much as a teenager. But I do specifically remember being really into Protest a Dark Anniversary when it first came out, and how, in a way, it was the last record on Kindercore that I truly loved. I was reminded of this after hearing In the Morning, so I decided to listen to the whole thing. I put on Protest a Dark Anniversary by Masters of the Hemisphere. And like I had done so many times before, I listened. This is the story of that record.
Hi, I'm Jeff Griggs. I was the second drummer in the Masters of the Hemisphere.
Yeah, he sang too. Sang backing vocals.
Yeah, they gave me a microphone.
Did a lot of stage banter too. My name's Sean Rawls, and I sang songs and played guitar and bass and sometimes other instruments, like primarily keyboards.
I'm Brent Mead. I sang and played guitar and the bass. I was kind of the go-to shaker guy.
Tambourine master.
Yeah, that's true.
Session tambourine player, the best tambourine player in the southeastern region of the U.S.
People think it's easy. It's not.
No, man. I've told people that. I was talking a bunch of shit, and like everyone's like, oh, yeah, he actually is like the best tambourine player I've ever seen. Many recording engineers have said that to me, because I'm like always like, this guy's the best. He is. You still have it, Brian?
Yeah.
My name's Adrian Finch. And I play keyboards and guitars, sometimes bass, like some vocals. That's about it, I think.
No, man, you played saxophone.
Okay.
Recorder.
I was hired to play violin, I think. We saw, like, we heard, like, Belle and Sebastian, and we're like, we need a violin player, man. Yeah. And then I played violin on, like, one song ever.
Yeah.
The foundation of what would eventually become Masters of the Hemisphere would form through the friendship between Bren Mead and Sean Rawls, who had met as teenagers while living in the middle Georgia town of Warner Robins.
It's a military town, so we're both from military families, so we moved around a lot. Yeah, I moved there as a sophomore in high school, and Bren moved there couple of years before that. How old were you when you moved there, friend?
I'd been there 1 year when you got there.
Okay. I think we had the same home room or something, and you brought a guitar to school for some reason, and I was like, this was early on, and we just started talking about music, and I had started playing guitar too, and the first band we made was, wait, what was the first one? Oh, Eat Rice on Friday? Was that what it was called?
Yep.
I played bass, I think, and Brent played guitar, and there was a singer, and then maybe some other drummers, like a revolving cast of drummers. And then Brent and I were, like, writing songs, but we figured out how to sing and play instruments at the same time. So
yeah, I think Sean immediately gave me a tape of his previous band, Karalti.
Oh, yeah.
I was playing guitar at the time, but was just mainly learning songs from Guitar Magazine, you know, like from the tablature, and I knew power chords, but Sean basically was like, no, this is a G chord, there's C chord, D chord, and so I just started like stringing some of those together and wrote a song probably within like a month of meeting Sean, and then we started playing lunch shows.
Yeah, we'd play outside the school at lunch, and there'd be a lot of people watching us. It was probably pretty bad, I would imagine. but it was cool. Like, at the time, like, people were like, oh, man, these guys are writing songs and playing. I guess we played covers, too, but we were, like, writing stuff. And, yeah, it kind of sounded like the Masters. Like, that's just how we naturally sounded when we wrote songs, even when we were 15. It still sounded like the Masters, but we just got better at doing those kinds of songs, even though, like, I would say, like, when we were 15, we didn't even know what indie pop was, and we just made music that sounded like that naturally. And, like, both of our songwriting was, like, mysteriously complimentary, even though, yeah, we probably weren't very good at writing songs or singing or playing music. And then Bryn moved to New Mexico after 1 year of us, like, playing together, and it seemed like Bryn, like, in my opinion, like, you just, like, holed up and, like, you worked on your four track, like, that was just all you did. You got, like, really, really good at making songs suddenly, and I felt like I had to catch up. He wrote, like, some of the master songs. Meteor is from high school, right? That's like a classic master's track. It's still good that Bryn wrote it in high school.
Following their high school graduations, Mead and Rawls would move to Athens to attend the University of Georgia. And it is in Athens that they would eventually meet Ryan Lewis of Kindercore Records.
We're like, we're going to go to Athens and start a proper band. That was the plan. Bryn, you're the one that met the Kindercore people, I think, first, right?
Oh, was that when I went up with Christy for orientation?
Yeah, I think so.
So I went up for orientation at UGA, and we were walking around downtown and went into Wextree, and Ryan Lewis was working at Wextree. I think he may have, like, pointed out a Kincaid 7-inch or something.
I think you bought the God Rays album or something, and he was like, my band's playing with them or something.
That's how it, yep. So we had already been planning on going to see the God Rays at the Atomic sometime in the next month. And so, yeah, Ryan said, my band's opening for them, Kincaid. So I'm pretty sure I bought the 7-inch from him then. So that's when I learned about Kindercore. And I gave him, I think I probably had the tape on it. Did I give it to him then, or did we give it to him at the
I don't know.
But a tape was given to him of our high school recordings. And he liked those. So I think before we even got there, we were kind of on Kindercore.
Yeah, got signed before we even moved to Athens.
Originally intended to be Kindercore's 8th release, the Nose Plug cassette would feature recordings from Rawls and Mead's high school projects. Ultimately, the cassette would not see an official release, the cause of which being, as Kindercore would later state on their website, the mysterious disappearance of the master tapes and suspected foul play. Prior to this development, Mead and Rawls had already begun to form a proper band, with Ryan Lewis offering to play drums until they could find a permanent drummer.
He was like, so you're coming to Athens to form a band. I'm putting out your high school band's cassette or whatever. But, like, I'll play drums with you until you can find a drummer because I'm, like, so busy with Kincaid. He played, like, one show with us, our first show. And then the drummer that we found was already in, like, four other bands. But Ryan Lewis was too busy to play with us on a permanent basis because he was in one band. But Jeff was, like, foisted upon us. He was in this band called the Mendoza Line. My memory of it is, like, Mendoza Line, like, yeah, I heard you're looking for a drummer. You can have our drummer. Not like, instead of them, but just, like, he will play with you. And then Jeff, like, was just like, I've been told I'm playing drums with you now. Like, is that what, oh, I don't know, what was your experience?
Yeah, no, that's how it happened. We were at some show at the 40 Watt, and it's actually, that's the time that I met you guys. That was the moment that we all met on Washington Street in front of the 40 Watt. But yeah, like, Tim was out there, you know, being Tim Bracey, and he was just like, oh, you can have our drummer. He was right here, you know? And then I was like, I'll play with you guys. Just because that's was kind of my MO at the time. I wanted to play, you know, as much as possible. I grew up in Marietta. My family moved down from Kentucky when I think I was about 6 or 7 years old. And I played in the band in middle school. I played trumpet. But when the band instructor would let me sit on the drums, I'd play the drums and stuff. And so, like, I always really wanted to have a drum set. And it's kind of a long story, but like I saved up some money when I was in high school and I went and bought a drum set, and my parents weren't super happy with me about that. And that was a whole to do. Once you try to do something that your parents aren't into, then that makes you like really, you know, want to do that thing a lot. And so, you know, I just decided that, you know, by God, I needed to maybe try to play drums in a band. And the best opportunity to do that wasn't really in high school that I went to, but I figured, you know, going to school in Athens, I would have lots of opportunities.
Griggs, Mead, and Rawls would begin playing together as a trio, renting a practice space in the Eastern Warehouse District of downtown Athens, known as Buckhead Beach. It is there that the band would record their debut 7-inch, going on a trek to Iceland, as well as meet their future bandmate, Adrian Finch.
Buckhead Beach was this big practice space. It had been like a huge, like, warehouse type thing, but it was converted into a dance studio on one end, and then it had been a club on this other end. Probably originally it was some kind of factory or something, I don't know. But me and my crew, we had a band called Bronco too, and we had been practicing there. And the people who held the lease of the place that everyone paid monthly rent to have a corner of this warehouse, informed us that they were dropping the lease, so everybody had to move out, you know. And we're like, oh no, we're going to lose our practice space. And so I was like, shoot, I'll just sign the lease. So I took over the lease for Buckhead Beach. And so that was my entry into a lot of different bands in Athens, including the Masters of the Hemisphere.
Buckhead Beach.
Greg Harmelink had like a little portable, it was like an ADAT recorder. And yeah, he just showed up there and recorded that. I recorded a couple times with the Mendoza line and stuff. And then like, I thought that Greg's, you know, recording was like pretty neat, you know, considering like what he was working with here, right? Like we didn't really have any music equipment that I felt was like kind of studio worthy. And that room wasn't really set up at all. It's not a good recording space at all. It's just this massive kind of cavernous place. And, you know, nobody, you know, that was affiliated with the Masters would have tried to dampen the sound where it didn't sound good or whatever in the hell, you know, we could have done. And it came out, you know, came out good, right? And then, so fast forward a little bit, you know, like finding out that that Kendrickor wanted to put it out. And I remember kind of getting my hands on that thing and they press it on white vinyl. You remember that, fellas?
Yeah.
And it was just like, it was a really, truly magical moment. I felt like at that point that like I had in one fell swoop kind of accomplished like everything that I could ever have accomplished, like playing in a band. Like it was incredible.
I remember we got the 7-inch and we were like listening to it for the first time, but it was at Buckhead Beach, and it was the three of us with Adrian, and Adrian was just like, this is a great record, this is really good. But it was like, I don't know why, it was like the first time we heard it or something. And then that's like, I don't know if we like asked Adrian to join the band then, but that's when like I remember feeling like, oh, he should be in the band too or something like that.
That band, like the band as a trio didn't really exist for that long. And, you know, I remember, you know, like, I don't have a specific memory of this, but I absolutely, you know, remember being like part of conversations around the scheming, right? And the scheming was all around like, how could we talk Adrian into joining the band?
Prior to Finch officially joining the Masters, the band had already begun work on a full-length record. Recorded at a number of different locations throughout Athens and elsewhere, Kendrickor would release the band's self-titled album in the fall of 1999. I don't wanna come down.
was like recorded with a mishmash of people. Chris Colbert, Chris Bishop, and Julian Coster from Neutral Milk Hotel. Like, they went on tour and they let us use his recording equipment.
Yeah, he had an 8-track reel to reel.
Yeah, we recorded a lot of it there. And then Greg Harmelink recorded some of it too. Greg was more like the finisher, I feel like.
We started
a bunch of songs and we're like, we need to finish these, add these couple things.
We got to go to Nashville and record it in this like really cool, like a brick studio that Chris Colbert, you know, had, but he knew what he was doing. And it was just this impossible slickness that I don't think that any of us had ever maybe experienced that, you know, up to that point in our lives. And then like the other half of that was us trying to do it ourselves. And it was like, you know, talking to Julian and, you know, he's like, hey, I got this like 8-track. Hey, tell you what, if you'll look after, you know, my house while I go out and do this little tiny tour with my little, you know, tiny band called Neutral Milk Hotel that nobody's ever fucking heard of before, then you could just like hang out in the house and record for free. So that's what we did. That's when we were recording that album, is when Neutral Milk Hotel was out touring around when Aeroplane Over the Sea came out.
The band would quickly follow up the release of their debut album with the concept record and accompanying comic book, I Am Not a Freemdoom, which Kindercore would release in May of 2000. In time, between tours and other musical projects, the band would eventually begin work on the material that would make up their next record.
Yeah, just kind of kept doing what we were doing, and I think writing songs. Yeah. We weren't like aiming for an album with that title, you know, or a concept or anything.
We had just put out an album and done a little bit of touring for a comic book album, right? And folks that understood kind of the seriousness of, and y'all jump in and tell me if I'm talking out of turn here, right? I feel like, you know, folks that didn't understand sort of the like serious, non-seriousness of this like comic book record that has like tons of really great songs on it, in my opinion, that like people are kind of like, oh Jesus Christ, here are these guys, right? You know, trying to play songs and like, you know, turn this like comic book story into something. Like the silliness of it all was like the primary driving motivator, right? And then this is several years later, right? And it's a time where like Kindercore is actually kind of beginning to take flight. And it really was just the fact that like, well, it was probably time to record the next record. And about, I want to say, you know, I don't know, you know, split somewhere down the middle, we had been playing a bunch of the songs that ended up on that record. But then a lot of those songs we had never really played at all before and just were trying to make it work in the studio.
Maybe one or two we never played live, period.
I mean, hell, I don't know if we'd even heard like Sailboat Kite before. We recorded a ton of songs.
Was that at the same time that we did the
Permanent Stranger?
Permanent Stranger.
Oh, yeah.
So those songs were all basically from the same pool. And it wasn't like we put all the B stuff on Permanent Stranger. It was, yeah, just trying to make an EP and an album, I think, out of that group.
I think that, like, bands learned that, like, if you have 8 songs, it's probably not the best idea just to record those 8 songs and put an album out, right? And so I think it was probably about the time of this album where we decided, we're like, oh, man, we're going to record, like, a bunch of songs. And then, like, pick maybe the creme de la creme of the recordings that we have and then put those on the album. And then everything else can either get in, you know, put in the scrap heap or used for something else.
Sessions for the record would be held at World is Myth, a studio housed inside of Kindercore's offices, founded by the late, great Bill Doss of the Olivia Tremor Control. As they had done with previous efforts, the band would eventually bring in frequent collaborator Chris Colbert to help finish the recordings.
Kindercore had an office in town off of Chase Street. And it was right two doors down from Chase Park Transductions, right, which is a studio that's still going strong to this day. And so it was very much like it was like the mullet of offices. It was like business, you know, in the front and then like party in the back. But in the back of this place, they just weren't really doing anything with it. I think they had plans for it, and those plans included building the studio. It was mainly, you know, Bryn that built the recording studio back there, at least the primary recording room that was in the back of the place. So it was a little bit of a hodgepodge of equipment in the back. I had to assume most of it belonged to Bill. I'm guessing that it was probably Bill's 16-track, one-inch reel-to-reel that was back there. Bryn, I don't know if you had pieced some stuff of yours that was in there or not at that point either, but, like, yeah, we recorded the vast majority of that record in the back of that KinderCore studio. We spent a lot of time at that studio, you know, because we had, like, kind of unfettered access to it. And, you know, nothing really was happening up there at nighttime. And so I remember just spending a lot of time kind of hanging out, even if, you know, there wasn't really anything for me to do. And sometimes the thing that I, you know, might have been doing was just like going over and hitting play and record and rewinding if people were trying like different takes and stuff like that. Chris Colbert was on the scene, but I feel like his involvement came in after there was like a lot of stuff that was actually recorded. Is that your recollection, fellas?
Ben was like probably the chief engineer of the album, and then like I don't know why or what happened, but we decided we needed to get it finished, and so we flew Chris Colbert in from LA, and he recorded a little bit, but we were like probably like 80% done with the album and the EP, which we recorded at the same time, and then he mixed the whole thing.
I don't think that Chris Colbert's involvement in that album was like meant in any way, shape, or form for him to be like doing any engineering work. I think it like happened that way. Sean, was it Give Me Something Clearly? And like you're sitting in the room and you hear something that just sounds like, I don't know, discordant, not to your liking, and you're like, oh, Lord, I need to get back in there and sing, like, yeah, you know, some kind of vocals.
I, like, yeah, I don't know if it was that song, but it was something where I was just like, I can't stand my vocal performance. I got to redo it. And he's like, no, man, we're mixing the song. And I'm like, no, I'm going in to redo the vocals. And he's just like screaming at me like, we're mixing the song and this is, you're messing up the I don't know what he was so mad about, but it's just like I'm calculating the risk here and I need to take it because
he's like
the rest of my life or whatever.
He's like Chris Colbert is kind of, like he's a sweet guy, legendarily grumpy. You know, that's like, I think like, you know, the folks that probably been in the studio with him would probably all agree that like, you know, that guy can get grumpy. We all can. When we were doing, I think, some kind of tracking still, I think Bryn was in recording vocals on this song called The Gauntlet. And I was like singing this like harmony part that, you know, I thought might go good with it, but I was doing that in the control room, probably in an incredibly annoying way to Chris Colbert. And I remember him turning around and looking at me just sort of like, you son of a bitch, you know, like, how dare you? An artist is at work and you're in here like causing trouble. But yeah, like I'm like, we did the vast majority of like the music playing on that record. And I think Chris was mainly involved. Like we were doing like vocal tracking and like overdubs and whatnot.
And in the end, they had made a record. I know what you're thinking. The album opens with Anything Anything. Originally appearing on the 2000 compilation Kindercore 50, the track is a true-to-form representation of the band's distinct brand of pop music. Present within the track are the hallmarks of a classic Masters of the Hemisphere song: earworm verse and chorus, earnest vocal harmonies, vintage organ tones, and a specific moment or detail used to elevate the whole proceeding, as is the case with this particular track, a soaring recorder solo. And though it was not originally recorded with the intentions of being Protest of Dark Anniversary's opening track, it definitely works as a proper introduction to what this album aims to accomplish.
Bishop just for that one song, and but then we recorded the album later and we had a different song that was the first track, and we decided that we didn't like that song the way it sounded. What was it called? It was called Canal Styles. Yeah.
Canal Styles, yeah.
It was a good song, but we're just like, man, this doesn't sound good to us. So we were like, we gotta take it off, and Kindercore was like, I remember Dan Geller was just like, this is my favorite song on the album. What are you guys talking about? And we're like, we can't stand it. We got to take it off. And we're like, here, we'll put this song, Anything, Anything, on there instead. Like, that'll be good. Like, people like that song. And then their response was like, well, how about you put that on there and keep the song we like on there? And it was like this big standoff. We ended up, like, getting our way.
So we played that song a lot live. Like, that was one of the few songs we had where we, like, learned it and we played it, like, a billion times live, and then we finally recorded it. And so we kind of, like, had it really locked in, I guess. Like, knew what we were doing, as opposed to, like, every single other song on Protest of Dark Anniversary. Like, we hadn't, even though, like, maybe some of those songs we'd played before as a band, like, anything, it was like a tour staple, live show staple for a long time, even before we recorded it.
Is that song any good without Adrian's recorder, like overlaid recorder parts on the end? That's what fucking sells that thing. Like, that it is a good song. I'm not going to argue that it's a bad song or something, but, like, that outro with the recorders and stuff, that's the thing that allows me to, like, listen to that song.
I mean, I would say we play it live, and without that part, then it's good.
Yeah, but we already have everybody's money by that point.
Yeah. No, I mean, like, people like it. But I do agree with you that when that part comes up, it's, like, very unexpected. You know, like, that's what sets it apart and just gives it the spice. At the time, like, lyrics were never my strong point. Still aren't. But, like, at one point, Adrian was like, those lyrics are good. They're very direct. And, like, I didn't even know what they meant. But then, like, I started thinking about it and, like, oh yeah, they do mean something, like, almost subconscious, that, you know, just like being scared to commit to something, I guess. And so it's like about, you know, having, like, courage to, like, really go for it, you know, and always feeling like you're trying to, like, hedge your bet and not, you know, just be cool and not, you know, I don't care. And you're afraid of actually, like, caring about something. But it took Adrian telling me that. But I feel like it already meant that to me, but I just didn't realize it yet or something.
Following Anything Anything is the thoughtfully and economically arranged pop of 200 Heads.
Songs and like building, adding stuff as the song progresses, you know.
Slow burner.
Yeah. And so that's what that song is. It's just like an exercise of just like introducing new elements, but keeping it really simple and catchy. And I remember at the time, like, I was really into the idea of like singing songs about girls' names that weren't real people in my life, because it was a way to avoid like trying to be too serious or something, but yet sounding like something that people could resonate with or something, you know. And so that's why, like, the Diane, I don't, that's not really about anyone real. I knew a girl named Diane in high school. Maybe Bren, you knew her, Diane Garland. The song was not written about her, but then later on I was like, who do I know that's named this? And so I thought of her. I was like, that's a cool person to think about, I guess.
My theory for a long time has been that, like, that Diane was Mindy, right? Because you would have been meeting her around that time, right?
It's possible, yeah.
Would that have been something that you would do, that you would have been like, oh, I'm going to try to write this song about this girl, but I'm going to use a different girl's name that has the same number of syllables?
Yeah, it's possible. There's another song where I sing about this girl named Jenny. That is explicitly about Mindy, but I don't know if this one is. Might be. But yeah, it's got cello on it. Adrian played cello, but I told him what to play. I'm playing the bass. I made up the guitar part, but I think Adrian had to play the guitar because I wasn't good enough to nail it with that super rhythmic thing. We got Jeff Griggs on drums. We got Brent Mead on harmony. Another thing that we're trying to do with this album is do a lot of like three-part harmonies, which Adrian also reminded me of this the other day, but I was really trying to emulate Fleetwood Mac with the three-part harmonies on a lot of songs. So Anything Anything has that, even though that was recorded earlier, but 200 Heads definitely has that, and some other songs do too. And that's, it's harder to hear the harmonies on this, but it is like Bren and Adrian singing a lot of the song with me.
I've always hated that song. Next.
In the evening when the windmills spin just around the bend, when the night is near, my dear, and the dancing ends, you will find your friend living in your hand. You'll speak to the one you seek who is waltzing in the noon. In a garden blessed from beneath your chest, in a night beyond the womb. And his eyes are...
The track Sailboat Kite is the album's introduction to Adrian Finch's unique songwriting voice. and acts as an apt representation of the character and charm that his contributions added to the master's body of work.
This was a real independent mission I had to make this song and just like, hey, well, I have this song. And so they were gracious enough to let me put it on the album. We recorded this one mostly at Bill Dawson's basement. And I remember there was a magical feeling about it, but poor old Jeff Griggs had to play that stupid repetitive drum beat.
That drum beat, you know, having been in the presence of a lot of different Adrian Finch songs that have gotten created, he's got a really great mind for rhythm in a way that is atypical for somebody like me who is going to be approaching playing the drums from like a real fucking like Aerosmith centric like kind of way, right? And so if it's not like a kick drum snare, kick drum snare, kick drum snare, you know what I mean? Then anything deviating from that part, right, is going to be a little goofy, right? And Adrian and I were lucky enough to spend time in Buckhead Beach with people who are like really big like Devo fans and some stuff that were like kind of introducing us to music that maybe we hadn't spent a whole lot of time thinking about different rhythmic patterns, that Adrian already knew all of that stuff. And I didn't, right? And I was kind of like a little bit more one-track minded. So that drum part, you know, it wasn't something that I felt like real natural playing. And maybe that's like speaking to a limitation of me as a drummer. I'm not going to sit down and be like, oh yeah, how do you want it to go? I'll play it just like this. I had to sit there and like really focus hard to be like, right? And like, I don't know how many drummers are going to sit down behind a drum set and, you know, have that direction like Adrian gave and just be able to like play that naturally the first time through. Yeah, you know, it's not like it's a hard drum part. It's just a weird rhythm if you're not accustomed to it. But Adrian, is that song about anything?
Yeah, you know. I think there's a little bit of death in there. Yeah, it's kind of a death song.
That's what I've always thought it was.
I don't know if it's by any space specifically, but you know, one weird thing about that whole era was the whole thing of, I mean, it sounds a little absurd, but it was real for me. Like, there's this whole, like, end of the world feeling with 1999. And there was this, like, disappointment that the world didn't end.
Mm-hmm.
But then, like, you know, when 9/11 hit, it was almost like, oh, well, maybe the world really is ending. And there was this weird window going on at the time, for me anyway, where it kind of felt like the end of the world again. You know, it was kind of like you're joking with yourself about it in 1999. And then you're like, oh, of course, it's not the end of the world. But then after 9/11, it was kind of like, are there going to be like more attacks here? Is this the beginning of a nuclear war kind of feeling? It was a weird little window, and I think that song kind of came out of that.
That song for me on that record has always just been a big favorite of mine. I don't know why. It's the one that I remember above all else, right? And it's not the one that anybody else remembers. You know, like, you want to hear some hits. Like, nobody, like, in the master shows, being like, oh, my God, dude, they're like, play some little kite, you know? But that's like, that's the one that I want to hear, right? And I think it's just because it's like, it's magically mysterious, because like, you know how to write a song like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was a weird time, like I was saying. Like, there was a lot of transitions going for everybody. I mean, partially just because of our age, and there were other weird circumstances going on with like breakups and all these weird shifts going on. It in a way, that album seemed to come out of an end of an era, you know, 9/11 was part of that, but it coincided with like everyone's done with college, you know, and shit like that too. Like, what do we do now?
With its base of strummed electric guitars, catchy melody, and Athens-centric lyrics, the track Local Government is a distillation of the Master's well-defined sound, and is the type of song from a band's catalog that accurately conveys to the uninitiated all one needs to know.
I think that the song is about how much we were going out to the bars and going out to the parties, hanging out in that era.
Bryn, explain the lyric, "Drive me down to the ER."
So the car is literally Rippy's black Volkswagen.
That's the new car?
The ER is the engine room. The engine room, was that like the biggest bar on that block?
Greatest bar.
The greatest bar on the block. Right up the street from the 40 Watt. Had an outdoor area. Local Government, that's in reference to, was it a lyric of Adrian?
Yeah, I feel like there was some like magical weekend at the house with Nick Cervini, and I can't remember all that came out of it, but
it's almost like getting at like how the town kind of like talking has eyes and like that kind of like local government, like the referring to the scene in a way.
There was a feeling that I had around that time. It goes again with this whole thing of like how long are you going to live in Athens?
Yeah.
And like, how long are you going to participate in this funny kind of... I mean, it was fun as hell. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But, you know, are you just going to party in Athens forever? Like, what's next?
Yeah. Well, like, Adrian, like, this... You used to talk about this, and I started feeling it, too. But, like, just, like, showing up somewhere, and you know, like, 90% of the people in the room, and they know all about you, what you're up to. Like, that's what I always thought Local Government was about.
Athens is pretty small. Like, you go to the grocery store and you see like 10 people that you know.
Escape it or something.
Especially after touring, you know, and then you go on tour and you saw these bigger cities. I think that for me, that was some kind of pull away from Athens. Like, it'd be kind of nice to be more anonymous.
Yeah, I agree.
It was on some commercial or something. PSA, right? It was on an MTV PSA.
Man, I didn't know that.
Do you remember?
Did it really?
I don't remember what it was, but yeah, I think you're right.
well, where's my fucking money?
It was a PSA. It was like, you know, like, drink chocolate milk or whatever.
Oh, okay, there's no money in that. Okay, yeah, never mind. Yeah. Hey, sorry to take that in a real negative place.
Indie Pop Meets Blue-Eyed Soul of Take Time is yet another example of the band's attention to detail's approach to song arrangement. Layering upon its steady rhythm section, a number of different instrumental textures, while at the same time, maintaining a sense of space, never allowing the track to feel overcrowded.
That was my jam, was just the, like, arrangement, building stuff, and structure. Yeah. I believe Bren is playing drums on that song, but I don't know why that happened. But Bren's a pretty good drummer.
It wasn't.
It
was me. And the only reason that I could tell you that definitively is because, like, I'm not proud of that drum track. That was one of the songs that we, you know, didn't really get a chance to play a lot, right? And like, or like, maybe it was introduced to us in the studio. And so, you know, my, you know, direction was, you know, we're playing to a drum click track and like, you know, like, keep it simple, stupid, don't do anything too crazy or whatever. I knew where the changes were and whatnot. But like, that one is one that just like absolutely kills me. It always did kill me on that album, that like, it's definitely me and it like doesn't have any kind of swing to it, because I didn't know how the song was gonna go. And if I knew how the song was gonna go, I would have played it totally differently. Yeah, and that's on me. That's not on anybody else in the band. That one is the one that is like definitively lacking to me in like, yeah, like coolness.
Yeah, it's a little stiff.
It's super stiff.
I mean, I like all the instrumentation in it, but yeah, I agree, it's a little stiff. I don't even know what it's about. We're talking about lyrics a lot. I have no idea what that was about. Maybe it was about something at the time. I don't remember though. This isn't good podcast content for this song, I guess.
No, this song's, I mean, like, if there's anybody who's into Take Time, they're listening to the wrong goddamn podcast.
Everybody knows the rules.
featuring accents of piano, glockenspiel, and steel-like guitar lines over its straightforward foundation of guitar, bass, and drums. The track Rules of Life centers on characters determined to rise above the limitations of the status quo.
There was a demo for that song. I remember Bren like recorded that whole song and was like, here's a song. We were all excited about it. Opposed to like something like Take Time, I assume was just like, hey, here, like we're actually in the studio and no one's ever heard the song before and perhaps it's not even fully written yet, but like that song was like totally done and demoed and we all like knew it inside and out.
Affected electric, right?
Probably just putting a slide on there, you know, trying to put a little country western feel on there.
Oh, were we using that backwards pedal?
Maybe, yeah, especially for that little interlude there, the instrumental interlude.
Like, how do you make that sound? It's just like a guitar pedal?
It's some kind of effect, I guess, and, you know, I had a little slide on a guitar, and maybe some assistance from somebody in there. I don't know.
Jeff, it's show business.
It's Chinatown, man. It's Chinatown. Look away.
I'm playing piano. I like that there's piano on this album. I don't think that we'd played piano on any other album.
There's a real piano on that song?
This should, yeah, it's real piano on this. I play real piano on Take Time. I don't know about other songs, but
there wasn't a real piano at Camp Fuller, was there?
You walk in that door from the outside, from the back, and there is a piano right there. And I have like a memory of the piano, and there was like a glockenspiel on top of the piano, and that's what I played on Rules of Life as well. That part is piano and glock, and they were both at the same spot.
That's wonderful, man. Kindercore Studios had it going on, didn't it?
Yeah, man. We were playing piano, or I was, at least.
I bet Derek Olmsted tuned it. He could do that shit.
Yeah, it was in tune. It was an in-tune piano.
Somebody wasn't playing around.
The misty-eyed romanticism of All Your Winning Numbers is a strong late-in-the-album cut that combines raw, sincere lyrics with an expertly executed arrangement of interwoven guitars, dreamy keyboard lines, and heartfelt vocals, both in the singular and plural.
Yeah, that one's about my now wife. She moved to New York after we faded for a few months. And what is it about? I don't know. Just like kind of thinking about maybe trying to make it work out, even though we weren't living in the same place anymore. And so Jenny is Mindy in that song. And Yeah. It worked out in the end, I guess. Basically, I think Jeff plays drums and I play everything else on it. Yeah, it's, you know, more of that arrangement stuff. This does have more of an 80s inspiration to it with the delayed guitars and stuff. And like the keyboard sounds more like a string synth patch or something.
This is one of the songs that like I didn't know when we were recording. So we just put a click track on. And I think I was given a little bit of direction about what to play, right?
Yeah. This was one we didn't know at all, just a studio creation. But hey, we can aspire to be Steely Dan.
If we sure. Want.
Even if we're in our early 20s.
Yeah. Chris Colbert.
Yes.
Colbert.
He was old enough to make Steely Dan out of us.
Jenny left.
The track Give Me Something Clearly is a post-punk indebted song that eventually builds to a transcendent moment of group unity.
Love it. I feel like this is probably the master song I'm most proud of writing. The recording isn't as great as I wanted it to be. The performance, I think, again, we hadn't really learned it. I think we had played this before live, but not much. But it became like a live staple that we would like kill it live every time we played this song. I just really like the song, how it builds, you know, like it has like a verse that's kind of faded, and then it has another verse that's kind of like shouting or something, and then it goes to that, what would that next part be, the chorus or something, like they give you something clearly, like that part's really good, how the chords turn on each other in threes. Usually you have like four measures, but the chord, there's only three chords, so the time it gets to the fourth, it's starting the first chord again, but the same melody is going on, so it gives it a more sense of intensity and urgency. And then like Adrian's harmony underneath mine and that chorus part, it's good. I don't know if like these days I'm so into having a ba-ba-da. I almost feel like the song, it feels like an ironic version of that or something, because it's like a more of like a dour sounding. But we had the four part harmony, or at least four vocal parts in that outro. I was very into New Order at the time, and that's probably the most New Order-y master song that we have.
That song gave me something clearly in the, you know, few opportunities that we've had to play it. That's the one, above all else, while it's happening, because it's kind of like such a big build-up into the end, there's been very few songs that I've gotten an opportunity to play on stage where, like, I feel the, like, goosebumps welling up in me while I'm playing it. And then, like, when we get to the end and everybody, you know, gets into the ba-ba-da part, like, man, it's, like, rewarding in a way. It feels like hitting a home run in, like, a baseball game or something. It's hard to describe the experience, right? I don't know if y'all have felt that before, like when you kind of like winding up that song and then you get to the end and you're like, oh my god, we did it, like killed it.
Yeah, man, it's a real banger,
and the people seem to love it too. Like, I don't know, it's just something magical about that song.
As we near the end of the record, we get the polyrhythmic gem in the morning.
Like, as an aside, like, most people sequence albums like where the second half is not as good, but I feel like side two is pretty strong on this record, which I'd forgotten about, but like In the Morning, it's a great song.
Yeah, for sure. I honestly don't remember if it was Bren or Adrian that played the drum part on this. I think it was Adrian,
but it was very like unconventional what he was doing.
To see.
it's a 3-4 song. Yeah, I actually had a dream that I went to, I think it was a Henry's Dress Show, or, and in my dream they were playing the song in 3-4, and then I woke up and wanted to take the song out of my dream, but really the only thing that I took was 3-4, time signature wise.
Oh, wow.
This song was just kind of about maybe existential dread. In the beginning, the lyrics are just kind of just about, I guess, anxiety in general, and then Adrian and I think, nursed the lyrics in the ending to be about riding a drill to the center of the earth, sort of as a metaphor for that dread. Yeah, and I think that kind of matches the sort of off-kilter rhythms. Maybe there's some, like, polyrhythm happening.
Yeah, the drum beat makes it sound like a drill for sure. You know, that reminds me, Bryn, when you said that, like, didn't we have, like, a lot of, like, probably every song we were like describing, like, this is what this song is, and it was like very like abstract terms, and this song was very specifically like, we got to make it sound like a drill going the earth.
Yeah, it's funny, I can kind of remember that now.
Yep.
But this one in particular, like, you adapted like a little bit of the lyrics to like reflect like what we were describing. I mean, this song is so good though. It's so great.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, I always thought this is like one of the most sophisticated songs on the record.
For sure. Well,
we completely, it got totally transformed in the studio, because if I just played it on the guitar, it sounds like just a 3-4 song where I'm strumming, you know. Doesn't sound like there's anything crazy going on until...
I would say, though, like, that chorus, though, is, like, really, really great. And that would have been good even if it was just you strumming guitar. Of course, like, everything that Adrian was doing, like, made it very interesting.
And we had the cymbal...
Oh, yeah.
What's it called? The roll? Cymbal roll?
Swell.
Swell. Swale?
Did we do, like, a cymbal swell? With, like, mallets and shit?
Oh, my God, yeah. I think I actually did a cymbal swell. Yep. Is this a song that I did a cymbal swell on, but, like, I suck at it? I honestly don't remember. This is the song that I did a cymbal swell on, but, like, I fucking suck at doing that. And you can actually hear it on the record. It's like a...
No, man, it's a convincing cymbal swell.
Okay, that's definitely not me.
No, it had to be you. It was probably the softest mallets, you know, like, it was probably made of, like, kangaroo feathers or something.
I'm not going to go so far as to say that, like, doing a cymbal swell is as hard as playing tambourine, but, like, doing a cymbal swell with, like, the mallets, it requires a little bit of training. Which I don't have. That didn't show up on the fucking Blind Melon records I was listening to in high school. Alcohol and cigarettes. Self-destruction's chalked up for more years you can't forget. It could have been so much worse.
The album's penultimate track, The Gauntlet, is an infectious power pop number decorated with surf rock organ and skillful tambourine shaking, offering one last burst of energy before effortlessly transitioning into the record's wistful finale.
That we practiced at Buckhead Beach, at a certain point somebody kicked through the wall and realized that the next adjoining space was a video game graveyard. It was so pack full of arcade games that you had to, like, walk on top of these things to, like, get around in there. And my favorite game when I was, like, playing arcade games back in the 80s was Gauntlet.
Everybody's favorite.
Yeah, it was like, it was so cool, the Dungeons & Dragons element, the collaborative, like, getting through the mazes and everything. You know, Bren came out with this song on the surface level from listening to the lyrics. It didn't have a whole lot to do with playing that video game, but it has everything to do with our collaborative experience, I think, with that video game and Bren's take on it.
This is kind of the back end to local government.
Ooh. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I never thought about that, but yes. You mean lyrically?
Yeah.
It is for sure.
It's not quite as happy, but it's sort of the aftermath, maybe.
Yeah.
Because I think I'm literally, like, talking to myself in this song.
Alcohol and cigarettes, self-destructions, chalked up more.
Four more years. You can't regret.
There's a thing with lyrics where some of them, they're just so apparent to you, and even like anyone, I'm not saying to me because I know you, but like anyone who hears that song, that I feel like those lyrics will resonate.
Incredibly presumptuous comment on my part. I recognize this for forever. It's always resembled the lyrics from Dark Side of the Moon of like, 10 years had got behind you. No one told you when to run.
I can see that.
I can see that.
Yeah.
It all comes back to
yeah. It is now official canon. But this song, The Gauntlet, has always been a huge favorite of mine. It's one of my favorite Master songs.
That's really good.
I think The Gauntlet was a name that was given to the song after you wrote it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it reeks of, like, the band is like, this is what the song is called, and Bren's like, okay.
But also, this is something that maybe Bren and y'all didn't know about, but the Gauntlet is also was a term they used for Highway 316 between Atlanta and Athens, which was always funny to me.
Because of the police?
Because of the police and because it's this highway and there's all these like crossroads that go, and it's dangerous because
it's like rolling like a steel ball through fucking gauntlet that you're controlling on a balanced plane of balsa wood.
Yeah, that was a reference that I had that I don't know if anybody else.
Yeah, I know that too.
The 316 is the gauntlet.
Yep.
So it was a very Athens song for me, you know.
I feel like to me, like, even though I knew that the band titled the song independently of, or, you know, like Bren wrote the lyrics, but we're like, this is called The Gauntlet. But like, it made sense because it was like a lot of the theme of the album in general, it's sort of like about growing up a little bit. And this song in particular is like the most like that of like having to deal with becoming more of an adult or something and like kind of like struggling with life a little bit. And so it's like, you know, like you're going through the gauntlet of like transitioning between being a kid and an adult or something. That's how I always saw it personally.
I felt silly when you called me. I tripped over.
The album ends with the poignant and sparse Summer With You. Nylon string guitar alongside subtle touches of percussion and melodica craft an atmosphere in which Adrian Finch's gentle voice muses on a memory, evoking a sense of nostalgia with just a slight hint of melancholy.
It's just another really Athens song, you know, and I guess it's probably kind of reflective of this kind of timeless zone of being young in Athens. So it's like a reflection of the kind of period that I felt like we were kind of moving out of at the time.
One thing that I've always liked about it is that this is an album that we recorded where if you come away from the record, you don't actually feel like you heard the last song, because the last song goes, summer with you. There's still a melody that's kind of recurring. So have you ever stepped out of your car midway through a song and heard it the rest of your day? Like, that's the way that the end of this album kind of feels to me, because you hear just a taste of this melody that's like kind of unforgettable. You're going to think about it later.
For the album art, Kindercore's Ryan Lewis would work on the final design after rejecting the band's original submission.
Okay, fellas, let me take this one. We're spending a lot of time up at those Kindercore offices and whatnot, and our friend Gordon Lamb has been hired to, you know, kind of take on this like administrative assistant role. He's a secretary. He's the one that's doing, like, you know, probably a whole lot of heavy lifting up at the Kindercore offices that, like, you know, Ryan Van, you know, maybe didn't have time to do or didn't want to do, et cetera. You know, I think back on this fondly just because it's kind of a sign of the success that they were having at the time. Like, the idea that, like, you got these two guys who are running this label, they got to, like, hire their buddy to kind of sit up front at a desk and, like, you know, receive shipments and package stuff up and everything. So one afternoon, we walked out. I don't know who the we was. It may have just been me, and I said, "Hey, Gordon, how's it going?" And Gordon, in a really exasperated way, kind of like leans back in his office chair and, you know, says, "Dude, I can't believe the volume." Meaning, like, I can't believe the volume of, like, how many records are, like, how many units are getting moved. And like, right then and there, I think, like, as soon as any of us heard the story, you know, I know that at least, you know, one or two of these dudes was there with me, you know, when that happened, and we were like, oh my God, that's it. We got to call the album, I Can't Believe the Volume. So Brent and I were living with our friend Nick Cervini at the time. And, like, Nick has a really successful screen printing business called Satisfactory Printing here in Athens now. But at the time, he was still kind of, like, you know, he was, like, learning the graphic design game. And he whipped up this album cover for us that was a picture of Gordon, right, talking on the phone. And it was hilarious. Like, we were all so into it. And we were like, yes, that's the album cover. We're going to call it I Can't Believe the Volume. And so we submitted it to Ryan and Dan. And they came back and they were like, nope, you can't use this. And so Nick went back to, you know, to work, and he made, like, I don't know how many alternate album covers, and they just, like, kind of rejected every single one of them. And it really is a question that I tried to get answered very quickly this afternoon by placing a couple quick phone calls to Bren and to Sean. I don't know exactly how it became Protest the Dark Anniversary, but, like, my recollection is that Ryan was probably looking at us and going, boy, these guys tried this dumbass comic book thing before and shot themselves in the foot, and now they're trying to do it again, and the songs are good, and so I am going to take control of this thing and not allow, you know, these guys to do this again. And so I remember sort of seeing the artwork and, you know, being told that the album was called Protest of the Dark Anniversary. And I think that, like, I mean, I would have to assume that we all just said, that's fine too.
You know what? I'm starting to think with that story I told about the canal styles and anything, I remember, like, arguing with Dan Geller on the phone a lot, and I feel like maybe when this album cover thing was happening, we were just like, all right, we already won the battle with, like, getting this good song off the record or whatever, like, so let's just do whatever they want us to do. Like, I bet that's what happened now that I think about it. Like, we're just,
yeah,
like,
when Jeff and I were talking, and I was thinking we were kind of, like, defeated at that point. Or,
yeah.
I just wanted to interject here real quick and just say one more thing. When Ryan independently went and created this album artwork, he had found, you know, this imagery that he felt, you know, represented, you know, the album itself, you know, the sounds, I guess, whatever. Our band, you know, I think he thought that it was a little bit more of a mature looking album, because I think the songs are a little bit more mature. We were, you know, grown up a little bit. And he happened to pick this image that, if you open up, like, you know, the album, and there's, like, a picture, if I recall, of, like, a marching band or something like that. And we realized later, and Ryan realized later, because he didn't have any idea that this was the case, but I think Jamie Huggins, who is the original drummer for Of Montreal, that his parents were in that band. So our album contains images of Jamie Huggins' parents.
Kindercore would release Protest a Dark Anniversary in the spring of 2002. And it is following some touring in support of the album that the members of the Masters would decide to take an extended break from the band, playing a final show at the 40 Watt Club in Athens in November of that same year.
When did you move, Adrian? Adrian moved first.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know when I moved.
Adrian moved to Tucson, Arizona. I think that was what triggered the last show ever, but I was also planning to move to San Francisco. And that's really what it was. Like, I think we were just felt like we needed to move on from Athens, at least at that time we did. And I don't know. Personally, like, I felt like we kind of just had a pretty good run. And then Adrian wanted to move and I wanted to move. I remember on our last tour around the country, we were both, like, trying to, like, pick out a city to move to that was not in Athens. And Adrian settled on Tucson, and I settled on San Francisco. And eventually, Bren moved to San Francisco and lived there for a while, and we were played music out there. Jeff was in, like, 90 bands after the Masters. Yeah, I feel like it was a good thing, and we're all still pretty close friends.
I don't think we were thinking about being a band or not being a band at that point. I think from my perspective, I recognized that I was really lucky to have been involved in a situation where I could contribute with a bunch of guys who were immensely more talented than I was. And so that bore out with Brandon and Sean moving to San Francisco and having an incredible band with Still Flying. It bore out with Adrian, like, you know, playing with Elf Power and like doing his what is the
Balalaika Orchestra?
Yes, thank you. These things that I would never be like capable of doing, despite all of the intense effort in my life. I was lucky enough to fall backwards into a situation that people around me, you know, kind of prop me up.
In the final moments of Protest a Dark Anniversary, the band invokes images of summer, a season commonly associated with youth. And like youth, it's also a period of impermanence. But Summer With You would not be the Masters' last statement as a band, as they have reunited a number of times throughout the years, as well as released another full-length with Kindercore, 2011's Maybe These Are the Breaks. But in a way, Protest a Dark Anniversary acts as a proper conclusion to what that band was. And while there are aspects of the record that the members of the band view as flawed, they are still able to appreciate this document for what it represents.
I think it's valuable as a snapshot of the tensions of the time and the hopes and the dreams and the disappointments.
I think it's a good timepiece. I think there are some of our stronger songs on there. I think looking back, the recording's rough around the edges. I don't know if we were ever thrilled with the recording.
Yeah.
Right out of the gate, but we didn't hate it.
When I listen to it, I only hear the flubs.
Yeah.
Because I don't ever listen to it, you know? And like when I do, I'm just like focused. I'm like, oh my God, it's like 8 more bars till I miss that fill. And it got recorded and it's on the record.
I wonder what it would sound like though, if we were however old we were, like 23 or whatever. And we recorded it now with like how easy it is to edit and stuff. I mean, didn't we record on tape? Like there's definitely no editing on that album whatsoever.
No, so there's none.
If you did it now, you would easily edit stuff and it would be like so much more pro sounding. I wonder like if all that would be gone just because it's modern times and we're just listening to something from 20 years ago that nobody really edited. And back then, if you were gonna get something like strong for us, like we would just do it over and over again, but we were never the band to do that. We never practiced hardly ever. We never, like, we recorded songs in the studio that we didn't even know, you know, like we were very like kind of off the cuff.
Yeah, there is the aesthetic, there is the good execution of it, or the bad, you know, you take both. I think that album sounds great.
I look back on the Masters and really like what we did and our approach to things and our attitude towards stuff. And, you know, like at the time, like I didn't think of us as like punk at all, but like now looking back, like it feels like our attitude and our approach was like very punk. Like we didn't care about doing anything other than like what we wanted to do. And even if that was like to the detriment of our, like our music advancement, like we were almost like against that or something. Like we wanted to make good songs, but like that's about it. And I feel proud of that. And a lot of other bands I've been in, There are a lot of things I would have changed, but I feel like Masters is one of the bands where I wouldn't have really changed anything. Like, I feel like it's good how it was. In that third album, I felt like we reached a point where we had done what we needed to do or something.
Thanks for listening to In Loving Recollection. A very special thanks to Adrian Finch, Jeff Griggs, Bryn Mead, and Sean Rawls for speaking with me about this very special record. Another huge thanks goes out to Sean Rawls for helping set this all up. You can stream Protest a Dark Anniversary and more from the Masters on the various streaming platforms. Seek this stuff out. It'll make you a better person. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram, or at inlovingrecollection.com. We'll see you next time. We'll get through this.